What is up, patrons? Welcome to the Hum in the Silence. This is the super episode here. We're going to be combining parts, volumes 9 and 10, into one big, huge episode here. First and foremost, thank you so much for supporting the podcast. I apologize for getting behind on a lot of things, but we're here now. We are going to be covering some ancillary material. Not only that, we're going to be looking at, I looked at the, recently found some resources online, for in specific Canadian UFO report, which, has become quickly one of my favorite journals from back in the day. The artwork was incredible. They had, guys creating like full length pieces and stuff. But there's a story in there that I particularly enjoyed, and it's one that I've wanted to cover for a while, that occurred at the Cowichan Hospital on Vancouver Island in 1970. And I found, you know, this kind of archetypical thing going on within other cases that were very similar to it. So I kind of wrote a bonus episode around that. So this first part, we're going to be looking at ancillary material from episodes 99 and 100. So episode 99 dealt with the Trancas incident in Argentina. And what I was able to find is that there were a number of UFO sightings reported in 1962 and 1963 that were kind of in the similar area. Like, there were a lot of just additional sightings that were going on. And in June of 1962, many residents of La Plata actually phoned the police to report cigar-shaped UFOs seen flying in circles at great speed, disappearing and reappearing again out of nowhere. On August 2nd, at the airport at Camba Punat in northeast Argentina, airport manager Luis Harvey was notified by his staff that an unscheduled landing was about to occur running out to the field. He saw a luminous object circling above at a high rate of speed. The crew had tried to radio the object, but without success. The object hung just a few feet above the runways, casting these like shades of blue, green, and orange light, and then it kind of just sped away from the area very quickly. Numerous reports ended up in the Argentinian press that month, including that of Pedro Antilli, who, 3 days later, reported seeing a saucer while driving towards Mar del Plata. The truck driver's engine stalled, and while he was checking on the engine, he saw an intensely bright cigar-shaped object hovering on the ground 300 meters, or about 1,000 feet away. It gave off an orange glow with flashes of pale violet and bright green intermittently. In January of 1963, a formation of UFOs was spotted over Bahia Blanca. If you remember on one of the bonus episodes that we did, we talked about the Bahia Blanca hitchhiker. Well, this is pretty much kind of the same area. At around the same time that fires broke out in this kind of like field. So they're seeing UFO, people are reporting these UFO formations, and there's these like fires just breaking out in fields. Another formation was spotted in Entre Rios on or around the same day, and observers had recovered particles that had fallen from them. They were composed of silicon, boron, calcium, and magnesium. On January 3rd, between Cordoba and Tucumán, and Tucumán is actually not that far from Trancas, a DC-4 plane was paced by a UFO projecting this vivid white light at the airplane at one point, causing one of the engines to fail. On January 31st, on a ranch in Canada de El Sogare near Tucuman. Two scorched rings with bands as wide as 35 centimeters or 13 inches. The rings were 3.3 meters or 10 feet in diameter and close enough together to form a figure eight pattern. Investigators found that the rings had burnt down to a depth of 10 centimeters or about 4 inches into the soil, which is it's pretty significant. Their conclusion was that it was created by something that got as hot as 2,000 degrees and didn't catch fire. They also found white ash on the rings as well. If you recall on episode 100, we talked about like the soil that investigators took from the Sunny Diverger's site and examined. And their conclusion was kind of similar because their thing was that it didn't catch on fire, but it was singed. So it just got incredibly hot without, you know, catching fire, which is, it's interesting. It's interesting to see that particular aspect. A startling encounter occurred the month of the Trancas incident in the province of Cordoba. Eugenio Douglas, a 47-year-old Argentinian truck driver, was carrying a load of coal between Montes Mays and Isla Verde on his way to Venado Tuerto. A violent rainstorm had just started when he was 3 kilometers past Montes Mays. All of a sudden, he was blinded by a bright light. He could feel a burning and prickling sensation on his face that felt like fiery needles. It felt as if his eyes were burning within their sockets. He collapsed on the steering wheel, and the truck veered into a ditch. Struggling to get out of the truck, he could see that the light was being made by an oval-shaped object on the road. It was at least 30 feet tall, though he could make out a few details due to the pouring rain. Then another bright light appeared on the side of the object. A door opened, and 3 tall, human-like forms emerged from the craft. He described them like robots 4 to 5 meters or 13 to 16 feet tall. Their clothing was tight-fitting and their heads were encased in glowing helmets, from which sort of antenna emerged. The beings, seeing him here, shone a beam of red light at him, which seemed to irradiate his skin where it struck. In the pain and the fear, he pulled his revolver and fired 3 or 4 shots at them. Then fleeing down the road, back to Montes Mays. Interestingly, there is an anecdote. Quote, at the very moment while this was happening, a number of residents of Montes Mays were taking part in a vigil beside the body of Señor Ribas, who had died that day. Suddenly, they all noticed that both the lights in the rooms and candles in the funerary chamber were changing colors. Now, that's interesting. Not only do we have, like, you know, the lights, but the candles changing colors? That's interesting. That's very interesting. At first, they became a bright red, changing then to green, and finally began to give off an asphyxiating gas, which forced them to rush out of the house. Arriving on the street outside, they at once beheld the strange spectacle of truck driver Eugenio Douglas running madly toward them, waving a revolver in the air and with his head muffled up. Out of breath and exhausted, he was uttering piercing cries for help. The house where this wake took place was located just on the outskirts of Montes Mays. Dr. Francisco Guillermo de Bolos examined Douglas and found that he was suffering from burns upon the face and hands and described these burns as, quote, lesions produced by unknown causes. So this could actually fit into like ancillary material for episode 100, which we will be getting to like right after this. But that's a crazy, crazy case, but so fascinating. It's very, very interesting. According to a report in the Tucuman Clarín, newspaper of October 25th, 1963, a hotel, the Hotel Termas, had been destroyed under mysterious circumstances. Some blamed an avalanche, while others blamed a meteorite. but workers at the nearby Ethel mine claimed to see blue lights illuminate the sky. And reports would continue to roll in for the rest of, like, 1963 into 1964, many of whom reported seeing these, like, bright red lights in the sky. So, you know, the hotel doesn't seem to be, you know, have just been destroyed by a UFO or anything like that, but it's very interesting. Turning to episode 100 in the hostel UFOs portion of the episode. In our episode with Derek Hayes, I mentioned the story of Ignacio de Souza, who was diagnosed with leukemia shortly after a violent encounter with a UFO. Death by UFO sounds like something you Google when you're like a 5-hour energy drink into the conspiracy rabbit hole you've dug, and you need to comfort yourself knowing that UFOs never officially killed anyone. Today, I'm going to break that assumption a little bit. Granted, none of these cases have their official causes of death as, quote, took a laser beam to the face by a UFO. But each witness died shortly after coming into contact with a UFO, or so they claim. All of these cases are from Brazil. And again, Brazil kind of has this reputation as a place where UFOs are hostile. We covered it in Brazilian flap episode, the Colares episodes. And I've covered it we covered it in episode 100. But the earliest case of, quote, death by UFO that I could find was that of João Priestes Filho, a 40-year-old farmer at the time of his death in 1946. Filho was a resident of the small town of Araçariguama, a place that didn't have electricity in 1946. Filho grew what everyone did, which was cereal crops at the time. Unusual lights were not common in the night sky. Nearly every villager had stories of lights making unusual movements and impossible trajectories. On the evening of March 4th, 1946, Priestes invited his friend Salvador dos Santos to go fishing on the nearby Rio Tietê. His wife had gone into town with their children to enjoy a carnival that was going on. The sky was ultimately clear that night, with a few stray clouds at 7 p.m. They headed back for home, parting ways at a crossroads. At 8 p.m., he burst into his sister's room, hysterical, frantically relaying a story. His wife had left a window open for him to climb through, but before he could, was hit with a beam of light from some unknown source. He threw his hands up to cover his face. He fell to the ground briefly before running into the center of town. Neighbors were summoned to the house to lend their assistance. One of them, Senor Araci Gomide, noted how there were no burns on any part of his body, but the man was in a clear state of panic. His eyes were dilated, and he kept repeating his story over and over again. Another witness, Police Chief João Malaquias, arrived on scene. Prestes told him that his attackers were from another world. Here is a direct quote from an article written by Professor Felipe Machado Carrion, who heard the story third hand from a dental surgeon who investigated the case named Dr. Irineu José de Silveira. Quote, but before very long, the scene rapidly began to turn to one of horror. Prestes's insides began to show, and the flesh started to look as though it had been cooked for many hours in boiling water. The flesh began to come away from the bones, falling in lumps from his jaw, his chest, his arms, his hands, his fingers, from the lower parts of his legs, and from his feet and toes. Some scraps of flesh remained hanging to the tendons, and none of those who were present dared to touch them. Soon, every part of Prestes had reached a state of deterioration beyond imagination. His teeth and his bones now stood revealed, utterly bare flesh. Pristis, meanwhile, vigorously refused the food and water that were offered to him, but at no time did he appear to feel any pain. Now his nose and ears fell off, sliding down his body onto the floor, a terrifying specter of progressive dislocation and mutilation, his eyes bulging with terror, his speech already distorted in a mouth that had collapsed. Nothing more was to be heard from him now but sounds, the meanings of which were utterly lost. Amid the scenes of general confusion, what remained of the body of Pristis, now nearing dissolution, was placed aboard a cart to be taken to the nearby hospital, the Santa Casa at Santa de Parnabia. I apologize for my pronunciations. But no more than 6 hours after Pristis had been struck by the beam of light, a corpse was brought back to Arasariguama. He died en route without ever reaching the hospital. End quote. According to Zhao's nephew, Luis Pristis, whose father helped transport him to the hospital, claimed that his body was not in that bad of condition. Like, it, if you read it, it definitely seems like something that has been sensationalized. But he did die from his injuries. So this is a quote from an interview that Luis had done with UFO investigators Pablo Villarubia Masso and Claudio Tsuyoshi Tsunaga. Quote, no, his appearance, according to my father, who escorted him to the hospital, was truly ruinous, but it wasn't that extreme. He had serious burns all over his body, his flesh was dark, and he presented no bodily injuries, explained our interviewee, making partial changes to the story, which had appeared in books and hundreds of articles published on the case. Like, this story gained a lot of attention at a time when UFOs were not really in the public consciousness worldwide. But again, these folks, and I think it's important to stress, may have not seen these as, like, UFOs in the traditional sense that we see them. They may have connected them to something else. It's not totally clear here. My father was a deputy policeman at Santana de Parnabia and requested the assistance of the forensic unit to research the case, but I don't know anything about the results. The fact is that nothing burned in the room where Jose was when the fire appeared. He had no enemies or anyone who'd be interested in doing such a thing to him. Even as he died, he repeated that the light had attacked him, and that it was, quote, otherworldly, explained our interviewee. The following item of information brought us back to reality with a start. Quote, back then, people would constantly see fireballs known as asombracos, or ghosts, in Arasariguama. Again, we're relating them to ghosts, not UFOs, and its vicinity. Some believed they came from the gold mine that's now closed. Other weird things would happen, too. My late father told us that around 1922, he was able to see a lobisomen, or a quote-unquote wolfman, while with my grandfather and an uncle. My uncle apparently threw a rock at it and hit it hard. The next day, a neighbor turned up with his hand bandaged. Other people told similar stories, Luis Prestes informed us. The idea that the Sao Roque area could be some fantastic, quote, window area through which an astounding variety and quantity of anomalous phenomenon gelled in our minds. Something equally scary happened to Emiliano Prestes, my uncle, and Joao Prestes' brother. A few months after his brother's tragic death, Emiliano was walking through an Arasariguama forest in Agua Podre, the same one from which the lobisomen appeared in 1922 and where the light burned Joao. A fiery torch appeared above him, causing the terrified Emiliano to run to a canyon's edge when the thing fell on him. All he could do was kneel and pray for his life. He told us that he felt an intense heat, but luckily the fiery torch moved away and vanished. Luis's account added even further mysteries to the area. The fiery torch, or fireball, was also seen on several occasions by Luis's father. The object would frighten horses and riders alike as they made their way through Arisaraguama's dark nights to reach their humble abodes. The lights were seen most frequently between 3 and 4 in the morning, and were 3 or 4 times larger than the moon. People would feel their heat even at a distance, and they were able to move amazingly fast. My father stopped going to parties at night because of these lights, Luis Prestes recalled. An odd thunderstorm rolled into the area following the attack on Prestes. That story is utterly terrifying. I don't even know what to make of it. This is another story that occurred 30 years after the death of Cecilio Higinio Pereira, who would rock Jobuchi Catubas in the Valley of the Old Women. Now, the Valley of the Old Women has been a hotspot since the 1940s. It's kind of where most major Brazilian UFO cases have occurred in or around this valley. Like, this area is where Belo Horizonte is, where has like a huge number of UFO sightings. I apologize, I can't talk. I need to take a sip of water. This area is just kind of a huge hotspot, and at some point I will be doing an episode on the Valley of the Old Women. It's an area that Bob Pratt, when he went to Brazil, visited many times to and gathered many UFO cases and printed them he printed a lot in a book called UFO Danger Zone, which is like all about hostile UFOs in Brazil. On the evening of August 6, 1976, Cecilio was walking home with two older women, Anita and Geralda. Like many of these accounts, the road was an isolated one, made solely of dirt. As they passed a set of charcoal ovens shortly after 8 p.m., the three witnesses noticed a bright light in the sky. Then it started to move directly toward them. Geralda urged them to run, and they all fled together. Cecilio, wearing only sandals, fell behind when the rope on one of them, his sandals, broke. He tried to run, but the pain from the rocks against his naked foot slowed him. The two women continued, leaving him behind. UFO investigator Julio Alexio met with Cecilio days after the encounter. The object approached fast, hovering just above the frightened man. He called it a train, but at close range it looked like an open umbrella. He cried out for Jesus and thrashed around on the ground. Then it was the sensation of an electrical shock. He could feel himself being lifted into the air slightly. He was cold and could hear a humming noise. Drawing closer, he could see three small beings, only 4 feet tall, from an opening at the bottom. Then, just as it was over, the object had just disappeared. Cecilio started to vomit and felt nausea as he ran home. Whatever the illness was, it would result in his death some weeks later. During this time, Julio was able to locate other witnesses in the area that had been chased by UFOs and had their vehicles disabled by them, too. A woman had been burned by a UFO when it came close to her. Other residents would report that familiar umbrella shape and the sensation of being lifted off the ground. For the next case, we head to Wales, and this is a year after the death of Cecilio. An unusual sighting would take place in the Nanticaus Hills at Carmarthen, and an unusual car accident would occur, resulting in the death of four people. On November 23, 1977, a BMW containing a group of rugby players and coaches, Phil Davies, Brian Jenkins, Benny Lewis, and Glenn Tucker, died when a tanker truck driven by Roger Godreed jackknifed on the road, cutting the BMW straight in half. The occupants of both vehicles were killed instantly. It's unclear what caused the truck to jackknife like that, as there was no clear indication, but investigator W.F. Holliday proposed that strange humanoids could have been the cause. Months earlier, on August 27, 1977, Francis Lloyd, a long-distance truck driver, was on a run. On board with him was John Dwyer, the son of Lloyd's employer. He was 16 years old at the time. The vehicle was heading for Carmarthen on the A48. In a dip at the bottom of the Nanticaus, the headlights picked up a pair of strange figures at the roadside. Here's a direct quote from Holliday's article. "The big truck carried eight forward headlights, making the road as bright as day. Standing on the right-hand grassy verge were two huge figures, at least 7 feet high and correspondingly wide. They're reddish-orange in color, as if wearing a single piece of celluloid suit. They had huge heads that were elongated upwards, as if they could have been wearing tall helmets. The heads seemed to be about a foot wide and 18 inches high, almost like guardsmen in busbies. As the light struck the figures, it reflected back at the witness. The two monstrous beings were standing together, slightly turned towards each other. Francis Lloyd had the feeling that they were holding some sort of instrument between them, although what it was, he couldn't make it out. He went on to describe aerial antennas coming out of them, made of what looked like chrome. They held a radio-like device between them, and they didn't seem to have legs of any kind that either witness could discern. The two looked on at the strange figures for 5 to 6 seconds as they passed by. They both felt an eerie, cold feeling pass by. The two acknowledged the moment and then rode on in silence for a while, bringing it up once more before reaching their final destination. There is no direct link between the two events, but still, what were these strange figures doing at the side of the road on that August morning?" End quote. An interesting case that doesn't really have any actual proof that UFOs were responsible. Or humanoids or anything, but interesting that pretty much at the same place months earlier, there was a UFO that was seen. For our last kind of violent incident, and there is actually no death involved in this one, we head to Puy de Dôme and the tale of the UFO soldier in France. Germain Tichtit is described by investigator Joel Mansard as a man of modest education but of great physical strength, picked to become part of a special unit of the French Air Force. His job on the warfront was to capture German agents at night. He carried with him a reputation for being straightforward, honest, and not prone to concocting stories such as the kind you're about to hear. After World War II, Germain took many jobs, and in May of 1960, he was a baker in Puy de Dôme region. He spent most of his nights kneading dough in a bakehouse at the northern end of town. It was at 2 a.m. when an unusual noise and bright lights flooded through the bakery windows. Adjacent to the bakery was an empty field, often used for fairs and other events. In the field rested a large object, much like a mushroom or a spinning top. The bottom of the object was smaller, vaguely shaped like the bellows of an accordion. The top of the craft seemed more transparent to the bottom's more solid, dark appearance. This portion was 15 meters, or nearly 50 feet wide. and contained four horizontal rows of light tubes that ran around its diameter. Each was luminous. A row of yellow, one of blue, and another of red. This portion also rotated, casting its light all the way to the ground. The object produced a powerfully warm wind. From a ladder descended a short figure wearing boots, tight-fitting trousers, and a gray-green jacket buttoned up, and a helmet. Germain described the figure as handsome. His initial thought to investigators, quote, "I wanted to catch the little chap," end quote, and perhaps sensing his motivation, the figure produced, quote, "a tube like a fireman's torch," end quote. It emitted an intense beam of light, which illuminated his head and chest. His breathing grew heavy, and his vision left him, but still he pressed forward, throwing his hands over his eyes, still determined to capture this creature. Now, I want you to picture a determined man wearing a tank top covered in flour and dough, being the hero we all need in this story right now. In the report, it says, quote, "he felt like his lungs were paralyzed." Like, what the fuck? No, thank you. In response to the man's resilience, the being got back in his ship, and with a slam of a metallic door, which is great, like, is this being slamming it in frustration? It seems to be that way, but I just love that. The craft rose up, meeting a group of similar objects in the sky, and sped off into the early morning sky together. I think what's interesting about mushroom-shaped objects is that they have been seen a few other times. One time, the Tuscumbia space penguin story that, the Kryptonaut guys have talked about. I know I've talked about on those Uncle Rob Alien Storytime segments from the What If podcast. But it's interesting that that motif like keeps showing up. There was another case, I think, Argentina that I'll cover eventually. It's a really interesting kind of classic case down there, but mushroom shaped objects seem to be, you know, the rage at times. All right, so that's gonna do it for that. For volume 9, we're gonna head into volume 10, and again, this is all material that I plucked from the pages of Canadian UFO Report. It is, they don't just cover incidents from Canada, though a lot of it is, you know, relates to, you know, Canadian incidents and stuff, but they do cover stories. One story that we'll touch on that I did pull from particular issues, one is from Sweden, a story from Sweden, and I think there's another Canadian story from someplace else, but Canadian UFO Report, yeah, definitely became one of my new favorite old journals. Just like the art is legendary in it. So when you stare at UFO reports for long periods of time, you tend to notice certain patterns, whether that's the Oz factor, the idea that UFOs can kind of isolate you, transport you into another reality without actually making it seem all that different. Like, this reality is very similar to your own, except there doesn't seem to be any sound going on. And perhaps you notice that a lot of sightings have occurred around military bases. You know, like, I need to do an episode devoted to that. At some point I will. You know, and those carrying nuclear ordnance, I don't think there's a base that's ever not been visited by UFOs. But for me, I tend to notice like mundane things that probably have obvious explanations, such as, why do CE3 witnesses almost never talk about the feet of the beings that they see unless they're like wearing coveralls or boots or something like that? And again, this stems from the David Stevens episode, which is episode 13. And I think what stuck out to me in particular about that aspect is that David would not talk about the feet, or he like, it seemed like he didn't want to talk about the feet. So Maybe I'm fishing for something. I don't know. Why do UFO sightings and alien encounters occur when people are fishing? This is a motif over and over again. And like the irony of, you know, the human fishes fish while the aliens fish human. You know, that idea is kind of hilarious, but like it happened to the Pascagoula guys, Jose Antonio da Silva, Ryan Sprague, of all people. There's that kind of irony that comes with catching people catching fish, I guess. One of the latest trends to cross my path is kind of very specific. So let me lay it out to you like this. A witness sees a UFO at close range. Generally, this UFO is kind of on the smaller side, no more than about 50 feet wide. The craft vaguely resembles the planet Saturn, or if you were a child of the 80s or 90s, a pogo ball. Yeah, I'm bringing you back. You remember pogo balls? Give that a Google. The bottom of the object is generally made from a solid piece of metal, whereas the top looks like a transparent dome. The midsection consists, for lack of a better term, a ring, a thin shelf of what appears to be metal. Most often, these rings are seen with a row of lights running around it. And for the topping of this weird ice cream sundae, two figures are visible inside, underneath the transparent dome. We've covered just a few of these type of sightings on the podcast, including the Reary, Idaho carjacking case, and the case of the San Antonio truck driver in episode 89, the Balians episode. Doreen Kendall would have just such a sighting in 1970. On the southern end of Vancouver Island sits the small city of Duncan. In fact, it is the smallest city by area in all of Canada. Doreen Kendall, a practical nurse, and Freda Wilson, a registered nurse, were on duty New Year's Eve 1970 in charge of the elderly patients in the extended care ward of Cowichan District Hospital. The hospital was nearly 3 years old at the time of this incident. It was very young, and if you Google it today, because it's still open, still running, it looks pretty much the same when they took the photographs that are included in this case about 50 years ago. 52 years ago at this point. Doreen and Freda worked the night shift on this ward, serving not only as nurses, but they would be a comforting presence for patients on end-of-life care. It was nearly 5 a.m. when Doreen went to check on a patient who was restless, walking into the room. She could feel the room was a little too warm, and walked to the window to crack it open a bit. Pulling back the drapes, she was hit in the eye by a brilliant light. Quote, "It was still dark outside, but about 60 feet away, right above the children's ward, there was this object so big and bright I could see everything clearly. The object was circular and had what I guess you would call a top and bottom. The bottom was silvery, like metal, and was shaped like a bowl. There was a string of bright lights around it, like a necklace. The top was a dome made of something like glass. It was lit up from inside, and I could see right into it." End quote. There were two figures visible within the craft, one standing behind the other. Quote, "They look like fine, tall, well-built men. They were dressed in tight-fitting suits of the same material that covered their heads, but their hands were bare, and I noticed how human they looked. Their flesh seemed just like ours." A feeling of peace came over Doreen. In later interviews, she expressed a want to talk to the men aboard the craft. She was mesmerized by an instrument panel that ran half the length of the craft. Because she was looking at the backside of it, she was able to discern what looked like gauges and levers. It was at this point that Doreen remembered that she was not alone in the room. Freda was with her, and just as she came to that thought, one of the beings turned around and looked at her. Quote, He seemed to look right at me, but I couldn't see his face. It was covered by a darkish material that looked softer than the rest of the suit. I'm sure he saw me because he touched the other man on the back. When the man in the back did this, the one in front reached down and took hold of something like a lever beside him. I'll never forget how deliberately he did it. He pushed back and forth, and the saucer, or whatever you'd call it, started to circle slowly, still close to the building in an anti-clockwise direction, end quote. The peace that had once come over her broke when the craft moved, at which point she called Freda to the window. Quote, I noticed Miss Kendall standing at the window and wondering what she was looking at. In fact, I was going to see what she beckoned when she beckoned me. And then I saw this great big light over the patio outside the children's ward. I'd say it was quite a bit larger than a car. It looked circular in shape, and the far side seemed to be higher than the side near us. It was moving around slowly, and then it started to move away. I didn't see any top or bottom to it. It was all just tremendously bright. Some people say we were looking at a plastic bag with candles in it, put there as a joke, but it would take a million candles to make it as bright as that. End quote. Freda later claimed that when she first saw the object, a tingling sensation pulsed through her body. Hearing the commotion Doreen and Freda were making, two other nurses on the floor, Miss Claxon and Miss Appleby, ran to another window on the ward to see what they could. They arrived just in time to see a bright light receding quickly into the sky. At around the same time the UFO was departing from Cowichan District Hospital, an anonymous truck driver and his wife were returning home from a party at 5 o'clock that morning when they saw a bright light that was as big as a house hovering over their home. While the man had a few drinks that night, he said that the sight of it changed his demeanor instantly. I don't know if I brought this up or mentioned this. This sighting occurred on January 1st, 1970, like in the early morning hours. We're talking like 5 o'clock in the morning or so. So if you're wondering why some intoxicated people are returning home that late, that's why. The object was ovular in shape and appeared to be projecting 3 to 4 shafts of light down at an angle, which formed into one large column of light. The object then shot upward into the air and disappeared incredibly fast. I may have had a few drinks, but I know perfectly well that had nothing to do with what I saw and what my wife saw, too. A UFO would appear to many residents at Duncan at around 7 p.m., a craft similar in size and shape to the one Doreen had seen, flew at low altitude. It was so bright that Mr. and Miss Arthur Gilliam, along with their friends who were attending a dinner at Deer Lodge in Mill Bay, saw the object from 10 miles away. Quote, all we could see was a larger ball of light moving quite slowly, much slower than an airplane. It must have been very bright for us to see it from that distance. I don't think a helicopter would have been that bright. End quote. Another pair of witnesses, Judge George Hallet and his wife, residents of Mill Bay, observed a gigantic orange-colored object traveling south close to shore. This was no ordinary aircraft, and it was no plastic bag trick either. It was making no sound that we could detect. It was moving very slowly, and it was enormous. I'm quite sure no one could play a trick with such a large apparatus without being spotted. We watched it for about 5 minutes until it seemed to disappear into the clouds. Another couple on the waterfront, Diana and Jim Drummond, were aboard their tugboat, which had been converted into a home. They were coming to visit Jim's mother in Mill Bay, anchoring their boat when Jim's mother noticed a strange light over the bay. Quote, I couldn't tell how big it was. It was so big and it had a yellow-orangey glow like sunlight, so I got excited. I yelled to my son to look. I ran out to the other side of my house, but I couldn't see over the trees. I tried to phone some of the neighbors, but I couldn't get through on the party line. End quote. Jim had heard his mother, quote, I looked up and I saw this light coming in from the north, just about in line with our boat. It was skimming right under the overcast, which was about 900 feet. I ran into the cabin and grabbed my telescope and camera, and my wife came out with me to look. We were really excited. It was sort of egg-shaped, in a vertical position, but the top and bottom were indistinct. It seemed to be transparent on top, and inside it, I thought I could see a set of lights, but I couldn't really make out any details. Jim's mother had turned on the porch lights, and when she did, the object descended 300 feet in an instant, passing between the boat and the house. Quote, just past that point, something came out of that thing, which by then had slowed down almost to a stop. It was a ray of light, like a thin neon tube, and it was in pieces, something like the dots and dashes of Morse code. It came down in a curve, and then it flashed right out, all of it at the same time. My hair stood up on end. I couldn't imagine anything like it. End quote. The object then climbed back to its 900-foot position and moved out of sight to the south. After these sightings started to spread throughout the community, Duncan Mayer, James Quaife, came forward claiming that he, along with his wife, witnessed a light brighter than a star performing strange maneuvers in the sky. A month later, things seemed to have returned to normal until the J, John Vanderhoek, phoned the police to inform them that cars were blocking his driveway. A crowd of people had come together to watch a red thing in the air. Whatever it was, it seemed to rise and fall in the air, its light changing in intensity the whole time. One other remarkable sighting would come forward after the January 1st incident from Alexander Elementary School in Duncan. There were scattered sightings of objects over Duncan in December of 1969. One report from Edith Bailing, who was very similar to the sighting of John Vanderhoek, had reported, quote, the ring definitely looked as if it was made of some solid substance. It was like a very large, heavy hula hoop, and the material looked like thick rolled up plastic. It seemed to change in its size slightly, perhaps because it was moving up and down and we didn't have any idea what size it was, but I'd say a large plane could have fitted into it about 15 times. That's a huge-ass ring. We saw it through a window from inside the school at first. Then we rushed outside to get a better look. We were all pretty excited, and I think there was one who was even quite frightened. I felt like ringing the school bell, but decided I had better not. End quote. Strangely, Saturn-shaped objects with two humanoids inside had been spotted previously. In June of 1968, in Barrhead, Yukon, quote, a farmer observed an object like an inverted dish emitting colored flames. In a compartment at the top, two figures were visible who seemed to be controlling the craft. As it drew near, the figures seemed to spot the witness, and the object immediately accelerated away, end quote. This is part of the famed 1968 humanoid flap in Canada that we really need to cover at some point. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating flap that occurred, you know, after everything had been going on in the U.S. for like 3 years. So it's an interesting flap that we will cover at some point. In the early morning of July 1st, 1969, Fred Hughes was on duty at an airport in Olds, Alberta, when he heard what he thought to be a low-flying plane. It sounded like a large group of people hammering on a piece of metal pipe, which subsequently shook the building he was in. From a window, he could see a large green elliptical object descended from a giant cloud to the northwest. It descended to within 50 feet of the ground. With the sun now rising, its light reflected off a window like opening in the craft, and from there he was able to see movement from two figures inside. He felt like he was being watched as two heads turned in his direction. The object was egg-shaped, approximately 20 feet long and 16 feet in diameter. Shortly after viewing the startled man, the object rose straight into the air and flew away to the east. Another report was sent to Canadian UFO reporter investigators by Dr. James Harder of APRO regarding a sighting reported by Miss Frederick Moreland of Blenheim, New Zealand. The story was carried in the July 22, 1959 issue of the Nelson Evening Mail Exchange. At 5:30 a.m. on Monday, July 13th, I went across the paddock to milk the cows. I noticed a green glow in the clouds. As there was no moon, I wondered what it was. When I was halfway across the paddock, two large green things, like eyes or big lamps, appeared above me and dropped towards the ground. I noticed that I was bathed in green, and all the paddock was green, too. It was a horrid sort of color. My first thought was, I shouldn't be here, and I made a dive for the trees, a stand of pines on the other side of the 3-acre paddock. I stood and watched. A saucer-shaped glow with two indented green lights in the bottom descended. The air became very warm. Two rows of jets around the middle shot out orange-colored flames. They appeared to revolve in opposite directions. The thing was about 20 to 30 feet in diameter. It hovered about roof height. The jets stopped, and a light was switched on in what appeared to be the perspex or glass roof or dome, which glowed. The bottom appeared to be a grayish color. There was a faint hum in the air as it hovered. There were two men in it, dressed in fairly close-fitting suits of shiny material. The only thing I can think of to describe it is aluminum foil. Opaque helmets rose from their shoulders. I could not see their faces. One of the two men stood up and put both hands in front of him, as if leaning over to look downwards. He then sat down, and after a minute or two, the jets started off again, and, tilting slightly at first, the thing shot up vertically at great speed and disappeared into the clouds. When it did, it made a sort of soft but high-pitched sound. I was so dumbfounded that I stood in the trees for a moment, not knowing what to do. There was a smell of something which resembled pepper in the air. At last, I decided to continue in and milking the cows. End quote. 2 weeks later, on August 6, the Nelson Evening Mail reported another incident that took place not far from where Miss Moreland's experience had occurred. Roy Haldaway, a farmer working at Dillon's Point, told of seeing an object at 4:30 in the morning of a green color traveling from east to west in the direction of Blenheim. Another witness claimed to see, quote, a very bright light in the eastern sky traveling in a horizontal position from north to south, end quote, early that morning as well. And yet, a third report came from the members of APRO and reads, quote, the first observation took place at 4 a.m. local time. A farmer in an area north of the town of Badas saw an object descend, making a hissing sound like an electric welder. It had a red light in front. The farmer took a flashlight and left his hut to have a better look at the object, which he estimated to be about 100 yards distant. As he approached, he saw what he described to the investigators as a white vehicle as big as a Volkswagen Beetle car with two occupants. The vehicle had a small wheel and six big exhausts at the rear. The size of each exhaust tube was as big as a man's leg. The witness compared the exhaust tubes with his own leg. The farmer described the object as milky white, and said he saw a transparent canopy on top, through which he observed two occupants. The occupants wore white overalls with earphones, on their heads, and they looked like ordinary Caucasians. Upon approaching the object, it emitted a loud roar, and the farmer ran off in fright. He then observed it more forward on the ground, on its wheels, to a clearing. Then it flew away. According to APRIL reps, three additional reports were made the same morning, of which two contained reports of two men aboard a craft. Detailed in another issue of Canadian UFO Report is a very similar report from Sweden. On May 3, 1973, at around 9:45 p.m., Sigrid Carlson went out on a walk with her dog in the Mantrup district where she lived. Looking up, she saw a red light approaching from the northeast. She dismissed it upon first glance, assuming it to be an airplane or a helicopter. When she returned home, though, she went back to the window to have another look. Quote, the light ball was going too slow to be an airplane, and it stopped several times. I realized that something wasn't quite right, and therefore wakened my 11-year-old son, Robert, to have as a witness, end quote. Outside, Sigrid and Robert watched the red ball hovering over a neighbor's house a kilometer or so away. It seemed to throb and undulate in the sky. Quote, when the ball started to move, we heard a sound like a jet plane that turned to a kind of hissing which seemed to fill the whole neighborhood, but it wasn't so loud that we couldn't hear our own voices. After 5 or 10 minutes, the ball of light came in our direction. We noticed as it came that it was silver-colored, then changed to a more yellow-white color. End quote. As it approached, Robert cried out, Mama, there are two men watching us. Closer now, the craft resembled two saucers, like plates put together, separated in the middle by a vertical beams which supported the design. There was a transparent viewing space through which two humanoid silhouettes could be seen. They seemed to bend over and look down at the witness. By this time, the craft was about 50 meters away and about the same distance up. As it passed overhead at about the normal speed of a car, the two witnesses ran to the other side of the house, where they saw the UFO hovering and swaying over a field. It went slowly back and forth as if looking for a place to land, but then made a U-turn and disappeared towards the east. Lately, this design, this archetype, keeps popping up in my research. And perhaps, you know, I'll follow this up, do a bonus episode and such on this, because, I keep seeing this singular image, this UFO with a transparent dome and two people inside. So, through a Google search, I was able to find an obituary for Doreen Kendall, who died in 2006. At the time of reciting, she was 59 years old, born in Kirby, England, in 1910. In quoting her obituary, quote, she came to Canada and lived as a child in Tekeski, Saskatchewan, later moving to Regina as a teenager. Her interest at the time was opera, being the lead soprano in Gilbert and Sullivan. In the 40s, she made her home in Nanaimo and Ucolette. I apologize for my pronunciations. She worked as a salesperson at Jean Burns and later became a practical nurse at the Cowichan Valley Hospital until retirement in 1975. She was also an avid horsewoman, owning and training many horses over a period of time in the 50s and the 60s. And that's going to do it for both installments of The Hum in the Silence. Again, thank you so much for supporting what I do on the podcast. I love y'all. I promise there will be another bonus episode in June. I've already started to write it, and it is to give you guys a kind of a sneak peek. It's about more modern cases that it was able to find in the MUFON UFO Journal, like cases that aren't very popular, but are utterly fascinating from like about the mid-2000s. So that episode will be coming soon. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or hovering over the children's ward of the Cowichan District Hospital. In Gray, we trust. I think they're just family.